Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. By now, you've probably heard the big news in education this week. The SAT is undergoing sweeping changes. The new test debuts spring 2016. The score is going to revert back to the old 1600 scale. The essay portion, no longer mandatory. Dreaded so-called SAT vocabulary words like pellucid and legerdemain, they're out as well, to be replaced by more common words that you might see in college like empirical and synthesis. And the math section will zero in on linear equations, functions, and proportional reasoning.
It's the biggest SAT overhaul in a decade. David Coleman, president of the College Board, which administers the test, says the new SAT is designed to reconnect the test with what students are actually learning in high school. It also responds to one of the most powerful criticisms of the SAT, that wealthier students do much better because their families can buy the expensive prep courses that significantly boost test scores.
While it may not be our fault, it is our problem. Because if these numbers do not change, we shall build an iron wall of inequality into the next generation.
That, again, was David Coleman, president of the College Board, at the announcement on the changes to the SAT he made yesterday. And in a moment, we're going to speak with a vice president from Kaplan Test Prep, one of the biggest players in the SAT prep industry. So listeners, parents, students, teachers, we welcome your thoughts on the big changes to the SAT. Do you welcome them? Or do you see some drawbacks? Does removing the essay as mandatory and changing the vocab questions make for a better assessment of what you've learned in high school? Or do these changes make you further question the relevance of the SAT at all? Call us, whatever your view, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. But first, let's introduce our two other guests into the program. Les Perlman is one of them. He's a research affiliate at MIT and former director of MIT's writing program. It was his research that heavily influenced the decision to remove the essay as a mandatory portion of the SAT. Les Perlman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Magra.
Also with us is Daniel Koritz. He's a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education who specializes in education assessment and testing policy. He joins us today from Cambridge. Professor Koritz, welcome to you.
Delighted to be with you.
So first of all, Professor, let me just begin with you. What's your first reaction to these massive changes to one of the more important standardized tests that students take before they go to college?
Well, it's hard to narrow it down to one reaction. This is a massive set of changes, and it's not really very well detailed at this point. For those of us who work in this area, the devil is going to be in the details, and those details aren't clear yet. But it does reflect an argument that started over 60 years ago. The ACT was created, in fact, by people who argued that the better way to predict college performance was to measure performance in high school. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, this is turning in that direction.
I mean, in fact, now more students, in terms of sheer numbers, take the ACT than the SAT, right?
Yes, that's correct. That's a reversal.
Okay.
Historical levels.
Well, Les Perlman, let me turn to you. I want to get your first response, because we'll explain in a minute why, but it was your research that heavily influenced David Coleman at the College Board.
Well, I think it was my and other people's as well. But I had conversations with David, and I think he agreed with me in terms of the old timed impromptu essay test really did not measure anything that was any kind of construct of real human writing.
Right. So let's dig into that in a little bit more detail, because I understand you met with Mr. Coleman, again, who's head of the College Board, in July of 2012, and he wanted to know a little bit more about this research that you'd been doing, about why it was that the structure of the SAT, the essay portion, we should say, in particular, may not have given an accurate glimpse into students' actual writing abilities. What was it in particular that you had found?
Well, one of the things I found, and I keep finding this with this type of essay, which is called a timed impromptu, where a student is given a topic that they've never thought about, and usually 25 or 30 minutes to write about it. Well, in the real world, no one is ever put in that kind of writing situation. You may be asked by someone, for example, at WBUR to respond to something about this program, but that's something that you've thought about. And even if you have to reply in 25 minutes, it's a topic you know about.
Right.
But, someone at BUR is not going to send you an email saying, is failure necessary for success? Get back to me in 25 minutes.
With a well-thought-out five-paragraph response.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And you also found that your research seemed to prove what anecdotally a lot of people had thought, that there's a pretty strong formula that you can use to boost your score on the essay.
Right. And the biggest part of that formula is simply length. That, really about 80%, 60 to 80% of the score is just on the number of words. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a high school student at Stuyvesant, who's now at Harvard and is working with me in further research, replicated my research by getting students on Facebook to give him his essays. And he discovered this, the same correlation.
Right.
And what he discovered is the only way that students got sixes, it's a 6-point scale on the essay, was if they wrote in the margins, if they filled up the entire book and then started writing in the soft.
So it looked like a lot. We're going to talk a lot about how empirical evidence is a big part of the thinking behind these changes in the SAT. But one piece of that evidence is, I understand you ran an experiment and you took 16 pupils who didn't do so well on the essay portion, gave them these rules, and then 15 of them, their score jumped into the 90th percentile.
Right. Well, they actually did okay. They did, they were scoring somewhere between the 50th and 60th percentile. And I was able to, just by a half an hour of giving them these rules and showing them how to do it, they all ended up getting 2 fives, which is the 92nd
right.
percentile.
Well, Professor Koritz, is this example of what Les Perlman is saying about how really it just takes some coaching, essentially, exactly what people are talking about when they say about the massive effect that coaching and testing and the fact that richer students have been able to buy this assistance, questions the validity of the SAT in terms of its ability to measure fundamental capabilities?
Well, I think it's necessary to separate three different questions about coaching. One concern, which David Coleman mentioned, is simply the equity issue, that some kids have access to coaching and others do not. A second is a concern that kids who are being coached are spending their time practicing things that aren't particularly valuable, which
right.
is the reason why Richard Atkinson years ago, as president of the University of California system, threatened to stop using the SAT. But there's a third that's much more subtle and harder to explain, which is that the particular items they use on the old test or the new test are not what we should be concerned about. What we should be concerned about is the extent to which performance on the test predicts something that's important, something much larger.
Mm-hmm.
The coaching industry makes its money by finding predictable patterns in the test and coaching kids to take advantage of those. It's not limited to the essay by any means.
Right.
And one of my concerns about the new test is that these three things haven't been separated in the materials the College Board has circulated. Putting even if one accepts the argument that the content of the test, new test, will be better in some sense and that kids are better off studying that, that doesn't get around the problem that if the new content is also predictable, coaching is going to be as much of a problem as it has been.
Right. Okay. So Daniel Koritz and Les Perlman, stand by for just a moment, because I want to turn briefly to Seppi Basili. He is the Vice President of College Admissions and K-12 Programs at Kaplan Test Prep, one of the biggest players in the test prep industry, joining us today from New York. Seppi Basili, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Magna.
Thank you so much for joining us. So first of all, I'm wondering if you could just respond to one of the quotations from David Coleman at the College Board that's been circulating a lot over the past 24 hours about the fact that the costly test preparation, this is the quote, that has risen around admissions exams drives the perception of inequality and injustice in our country, and that the new SAT is designed in part, according to Coleman, to address that.
So, obviously, a couple of reactions. So I think the move to provide free test preparation and access to free test preparation is a great one. We've been doing it for 20 years, and we recognize the value of test prep. I think you're calling, however, I think, you know, in Coleman's remarks, inequality in American education doesn't start and end at test prep. You know, families choose to move to particular communities in suburban Boston because they're desperate to have their student attend a particular high school. And more than 9% of Americans make the decision to send their kids to private school. And usually that's because, in addition to maybe having a more values-laden education, they're also looking for an education where their students are going to do better in the college admissions process and end up at a more rigorous college. Mm-hmm. So I think SAT test prep is an issue, and I think making it free is really a right direction, but I don't think it's the cause of great inequality in American education. That's just putting a little bit too much on an industry that's not that big.
I see. Well, it may be that it may be helping to drive perceived inequality or measurable inequality in terms of the scores on the SAT in particular. But let me ask you, you mentioned the free test prep, and that's because the SAT is now going to partner with the Khan Academy, this free online resource that will be providing, I guess, online tutorials for the new test when it comes out in 2016. The overall test prep industry in the United States today is a multi-billion dollar a year industry. Is Kaplan at all concerned that this change by the College Board could, have an effect on your bottom line?
No. I think the short answer is no, and a couple of reasons why. First, for 40 years, the College Board told folks that test preparation didn't work. And so one of the things that this announcement does is really create a new norm, that test preparation is where students should fall. And I think some of the direction of what Professor Koritz was mentioning around performance and predictability and tests, everyone will continue to want to seek an edge. And part of what we do at Kaplan is to provide a variety of programs for students, whether that be online programs or tutors who go to students' homes, in order to help them do their best. Remember, too, that the SAT hasn't always tried to measure overall academic success. It is trying to help shed light on how students will perform as freshmen in college, and it does also try and create fine line distinctions between one student or another. Harvard annually lets us know that they could fill their class more than once, more than twice, probably three times with equally qualified candidates. Mm-hmm. Yet, one of the things they use are tests like the SAT to help them make those distinctions.
Right. Now, finally, I just want to ask you, I'm sure you've seen this quotation in the New York, it appeared in the New York Times today. It's from Philip Bollinger, who's the director of undergraduate admissions at the University of Washington. And he said that he basically thinks it's absurd how much test prep has grown and how, in his words, guilt-ridden parents have become, guilt-ridden parents have become about trying to prep their kids for the test. Your reaction to that so much of this has been, the growth of the industry has been driven by the fact that this is the way that families think it's the best way to prep their kids for the test.
I don't think anyone thinks it's the best way. I think they think it's an important way to do that. You know, if you go to visit Tennessee, if you get a 24 on the ACT, you have a 25% automatic scholarship to the University of Tennessee. Or the University of Georgia, which provides a HOPE scholarship, which is full tuition for students. And now the average SAT scores at the University of Georgia are approaching 1,950, which is an astronomical change in 20 years. There are really big stakes for American families, and the SAT helps contribute to students doing better in that process.
Seppi Basili is the Vice President of College Admissions and K-12 Programs at Kaplan Test Prep, speaking to us from New York today. Mr. Basili, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So Les Perlman and Daniel Koritz, let me turn back to you. First of all, Les, what's your response to what you heard Seppi Basili say, that he doesn't think this is going to have much of an impact on the test prep industry?
Well, I think it's going to have a tremendous impact. I agree that the devil is going to be in the details. The more open-ended the questions are, the harder it's going to be to have formulaic test prep for it. Also, there's the reality that if the test prep is real education, if it's actually educating students to things that we want them to learn, then it should be occurring in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Right now, test prep is really focused on things like when I trained those students to score higher, the last thing I told them was never write like this again. And, they could get a high score. And this comes from my own experience as a director of first-year writing,
right,
that one of the things people do in first-year writing, especially at elite institutions, is deprogram students from writing five-paragraph essays.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the more open-ended the questions may be. For example, I'm seeing that new questions might include the fact that students will be asked not just to select the right answer, but justify it by choosing a quotation from a provided text that would provide the best supporting evidence for that answer. Daniel Koretz, I heard Seppi Basili say that the SATs, the purpose of the SAT was to predict success in college, but it also seems as if there have been a spate of very recent pieces of research that come out that said, you know, it is not the best tool to predict college success. I mean, there's William Hiss, who was the former dean of admissions at Bates College, looked at what a number of the colleges that no longer require the SAT or even ACT for admissions, and found out that students who don't take, you know, these standardized tests do just fine. And in fact, a better predictor is how they did in their grades in high school.
Well, there's literally decades worth of research on this topic, and most of it shows that college admissions test scores do predict. They don't predict terribly well, but the fact is, in this country, nothing predicts terribly well. Even if you add in high school grade point average and test scores, you're largely still shooting in the dark when you admit a freshman class. That's not surprising if you think back to what freshman year in college was like. The in most studies that I have seen, high school grade point average is a slightly better predictor than test scores, not vastly so. But there is a very serious problem with relying only on high school grades, which is that grading standards are not consistent across schools, mm-hmm, and they're not consistent across categories of schools. For instance, there was a study years ago finding that grading tended to be more lenient in high-poverty schools. So it's helpful for admissions officers to have something which is standardized across high schools.
Right.
Whether this new test is going to be any better than the old in terms of predicting, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. But I do want to pick up on one aspect of that. We're trying to do, or the College Board is trying to do, two different things with this test from what they've said so far. One is to predict what students will do in college, and the second is to measure what they've done in high school.
Right.
Those may or may not be the best thing. Those may or may not turn out to be doable well in a single test.
I just wanted to ask you about that because, you know, we've heard and seen in news coverage that David Coleman says part of the goal is to realign the test with what students are actually learning in high school. And is that the point that you're getting? Like, can you do that at the same time while also predicting the higher level thinking required for college?
Well, you can to some degree. I think it's an open question what this test is going to look like, how well it's going to serve either of those functions. It's a fairly short test compared to the amount of time that kids spend in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to measure all of what they learn or even necessarily all of what they learn in one subject like math. So I think the devil is going to be in the details. We'll have to see how well this test does at measuring what students are studying and how well it does at predicting
right.
performance in college.
Listeners, we're talking about the major changes coming to the SAT. It's going to be a completely different test come spring 2016. The essay will be, you can take it by choice. It will no longer be mandatory. That's one of the many changes to this college admissions test, and we want to know what you think. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We got a tweet from Eric Bryce who says, I'm probably in the minority. I chose the SAT over the ACT for its irrelevance. Less practical equals better score for being smart. Let's take a call from Waltham. Josh is on the line. You're on the air, Josh.
Hi. My question is, does these new changes for the SAT make the ACT now a harder test, or will the new SAT live up to the standards that the SAT we have now has?
Josh, thanks for your question. Daniel Koretz, do you have a response to that?
Well, first, we don't know what the test will look like or how people will perform. But typically, what happens is schools will get normed data, that is to say, norms saying that kids who scored at a certain point are in the, say, the 70th percentile rank, the 80th percentile rank. And there, I'm certain, will be studies that link the two tests, provide concordance tables between the two tests. So I don't think the difficulty really is the issue as much as it is the change in content and format.
Mm. And Les Perlman, you wanted to jump in a little bit while ago.
Yes, well, I would say that the devil is really, again, the devil is in the details, and that we don't know what it's going to be like, but that I would say that high school grades, especially if you view them with other factors such as the percentage of students at that particular high school who go on to four-year colleges, becomes a much better predictor than standardized tests.
Mm. Let me ask you less about one other change that we haven't talked that much about, and that is the vocabulary that's going to be featured in the SAT. A lot of those famed SAT words that people supposedly never use won't be in the test anymore, and the College Board says students are going to be asked questions on words they might actually encounter in college. But I've seen some critics of this change say, why not emphasize complex vocabulary that students should strive to know? And they wonder if this portion of the test is essentially a dumbing down.
Oh, I disagree. This is probably the single change that I applaud most highly. People who teach freshman comp, first-year comp at especially elite schools, find students who got there because they were very good at mastering SAT words, and they would write, end up writing essays that are full of, egregious and plethora. And what they need to learn is to, quote Strunk, avoid needless words.
Mm. All right, well, let's take another call here. Michael's calling from Florida. You're on the air, Michael.
Hello. I'm calling because I'm elated to hear about the changes in the SAT. I was a woeful underachiever in high school. I was too focused on athletics, and I floundered in the classroom to the extent that I was politely discouraged from taking either the SAT or ACT. And my saving grace was really an excellent grounding in the ability to read. And in the years following high school, I stumbled here and there. I found something that I loved. And in fact, one of your panelists, I was accepted to the School of Education at Harvard in 78, primarily based on nothing but having a high school education. Mm. They asked me to take the Miller Analogies test, and I see some relation between the MAT and the SAT and the fact that you have that to have that ability to discern the meaning of words.
Right. So it sounds like to me, Michael, that you say that your ability to teach yourself and the what you learned from life mattered more in the long run.
Primarily the ability to read, having some curiosity and finding something I loved that took an interest, because much of the formal learning in our country almost discourages the middle of the road mm-hmm. student, the underachievers. And I'm fortunate in that I was able to find something that took my interest and was successful at it.
Michael, I'm going to take it from you there. Thank you so much for your call, because what you said just triggered a question in my mind, and I'm going to throw it both to Daniel and Les here. Daniel Koritz, a lot of people have looked at this and wonder if the changes to the test are going to basically realign scores upwards, because that's what happened in the past, in 2005 and earlier when the SAT made major changes. Because there was for several years a decline in average SAT scores. And so some folks are wondering, maybe, by changing it so that the average scores might go up, they might inadvertently be masking a deeper problem with a decline in educational standards overall.
Well, actually, test scores have been going up in general for quite some time. I think there's another problem lurking here, though, that this test is going to be very different from the old one. And for that reason, I wouldn't, if I were in their shoes, even put it on the same scale. Mm-hmm. I don't think it will be meaningful to say a person got a 1,500 on this since it's comparable to a 1,500 on the previous test. Well, I should say it won't be terribly meaningful. I would actually put it on an entirely new scale and discourage people from trying to compare performance from one test to the other.
Right. And also the scores on these tests are normed.
They're normed. Okay.
You know, that 500 is when during the Norman period, when they pilot it, 500 is average. 100 points is a standard deviation.
Well, Les Perlman is the former director of writing at MIT, and he's also currently a research affiliate at MIT. It was some of his research, in part, that got the College Board thinking maybe it should no longer require the essay portion of the SAT, which is indeed what has happened. Les Perlman, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you very much, Megan.
And Daniel Koritz, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He specializes in educational assessment and testing policy. Great to have you, Professor Koritz. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, continue this conversation about SAT changes online. Let us know what you think. Send us a comment at radioboston.org. But stick with us, because coming up, we'll hear the biography, or we'll talk to the author, I should say, of a new biography of civil rights leader Stokely Carmichael. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.